You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and you are listening to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're still celebrating the Feast of St. John of Kronstadt, November 1st and 2nd, 2024. As always, my donors keep me independent as I continue to scale down to save money and dedicate as much as I possibly can to this project, you know, which is really my life's work and struggle. I talk about the regime. I've defined it over and over again. I've talked about many of its policies, sometimes repeatedly, and why these policies are promoted and imposed by them. But today, we're going to talk about food. I've brought this up before because this is connected with agrarianism. Agrarianism is the negation of this postmodern capitalist transhumanism. And I want to work with three more or less good articles on the food industry and its connection to the ideology of the regime. Of course, control of food supplies, GMOs, etc., are a key component of the regime's web of control and coercion. There was a self-described feminist in Italy, Silvia Guarnini. She calls herself a radical ecologist, and she wrote a book in 2023, From the Neutral Body to the Post-Human Cyborg, A Critique of Gender Ideology. I'm going to mention her a couple of times, and I'm hoping that there's a trend here where you have these leftists who are starting to make arguments that sound exactly like ours. Nationalist, medievalist, Russian Orthodox, monarchist worldview, whichever part of that you want to emphasize. And here's what she said. A total demolition of the previous forms of existence is underway. How one comes into the world, biological sex, education, relationships, the family, even the diet, that is soon to become synthetic. Well, I'm glad she got the memo, but even leftists are, and we'll see even more rightist-style quotes from her in a bit. This article is not about her, but I'm hoping this is some sort of a trend. In my article on, I have many articles on agrarianism, but the one I posted to Patreon last month, or the month before, I criticized the left in its make-believe agrarian communalism. But in that process, there may be some who actually, because, you know, she needs to answer the question here. Where did this come from? What's the ontological foundation of this contempt of nature whereby everything becomes synthetic? And that gets her into dangerous territory, and a bunch of leftists here. And I'm hoping that this is a means of entry. But these leftists now are saying things that I got fired from academic jobs from just 10 years ago. Anyway, it reminds me of one of my favorite works of Russian literature, Anton Chekhov's The Black Monk, written in 1894. There, the anti-hero named Kovrin, he is visited by a demonic apparition that tells him he is a genius, and in fact, through his knowledge of science and philosophy, he will bring humanity to its true purpose and highest calling. He will fix the world. Through science, he's told, his own agency, there will be a coming age of plenty, soon to be, at hand. These kind of promises, it's clear that the apparition is a demon, that there is this presence, that God, quote-unquote, has chosen people that will move evolution forward to create a new order based on what Francis Bacon many centuries ago called the New Atlantis, that is to say, scientific knowledge controlled by an oligarchy of science and its connection with money that will solve our problems. Covern is told that his job is to fix the world and that people around him are too ignorant to understand him. He is dimly aware that he is mentally ill, but he can't tell whether that's a product of his genius or that this entire thing is a schizophrenic hallucination. But he convinces himself that it's just, well, I'm not part of the herd, and that's why I'm crazy. I'm just considered crazy. He is a representative of the deluded revolutionaries and nihilists. And remember, in Russia, nihilists were those who only believed in positivism, the empirical scientific method. Covrin becomes an absolute monster. I know I've mentioned this a few times before, but it continues to... I mean, clearly Chekhov is a right-winger. He never gets that credit. He becomes a monster. He marries a very frail girl named Tanya. Usually, people like her are representatives of old Russia. Russia in Russian literature is usually represented by the writers that I deal with as a simple girl or woman, one who often ends up rejected. She marries Tanya because he convinces her that he is, in fact, destined for greatness. She doesn't have much of a life, and this man will give her purpose and a calling. But Covrin is not mentally ill. He's, in fact, possessed. He tortures this poor girl to the point where she has to divorce, or actually he divorces her, mocking her father, calling her a country bumpkin, believing her to be inferior. And of course, Covrin takes up with an older woman, one who is more at his level. He gets a hemorrhage in his throat. Covrin dies in a pool of blood, but the apparition appears to him one more time and says, well, your death is needed because your body cannot handle being controlled by a spirit of such genius. I've used that story quite often because this is the foundation of the arrogance of the scientific establishment that often goes by the abstraction science. This is a Judaic tikkun olam, the conceit that elite Jews will fix what is wanting in nature, releasing what it's meant to be. Yeah, it's science, but it's an ethnically based science, both biological and social. But the image of the black monk is the very demonic presence that motivates this kind of thinking. And all attempts lead to misery and failure. And this is the background to understand the regime's ideology on most things, really. But today we're going to deal with a few articles in food production, farming, and their negation of agrarianism. Because agrarianism has to be a part of an ethno-nationalist or royalist mentality. And part of this today, given the Great Reset and the trillionaires who finance it all, transhumanism. And that's an excellent first step in understanding what the regime has in store. Normies know almost nothing about this. Maybe they have a vague conception that something is wrong, but either they won't or can't talk about it. A very good author in this regard is Colin Toadhunter, who has a book out on this topic, several articles that I've come across, and he puts together, of course, what I've been saying for a very long time, but maybe his audience doesn't know that much about the corporate consolidation, especially post-COVID, of this supply chain of the agribusiness world and its connection with the digital conglomerates like, you know, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, who have now connected themselves, it's really all the same oligarchy, it's one and the same regime, connected themselves with agribusiness, you know, Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland, and to destroy what's left of normal farming. Many of the big foundations, Bill and Melinda Gates, the entirely Jewish BlackRock organization. They're all involved. I first brought this up relative to Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett, who has ConAgra as a part of this massive conglomerate. And what they're doing is buying up massive tracts of farmland, promoting and in fact requiring biosynthetic foods, GMOs, and attempting to and succeeding in forcing what's left of normal farmers into dependency on them. Now they think, or they're promoting the idea that this is a humane crusade. They're gonna save the planet, because we all know that global warming is going to destroy us all. This is just another aspect of imperialism, and many on the left are starting to notice this. You can't have imperialism without nations. And of course, like everything else, it's a drive for a one-world agriculture based on genetically engineered seeds, all kinds of lab-created products that sort of kind of look like food. They've invented all kinds of data-driven agriculture farming without farmers, lab to table, and of course all of this is governed by the regime, these e-commerce platforms determined by AI and all the rest. Now, he's written a book, a very good one, called Food Dispossession and Dependency, Resisting the New World Order, which came out in 2022. For my listeners, most of this won't be new, because I've been talking about it most of my adult life. But this is an excellent passage that I think you may like. Together with Archer Daniels Midland, Bung and Dreyfus, Cargill controls more than 70% of the world's grain trade. None of these firms are under any obligation to disclose what they know about global markets, including their own grain stock. This lack of transparency around the true amounts of grain and storage following Russia's invasion of Ukraine was a key factor fueling speculation on food markets and inflated prices. Aside from manipulating markets and prices, these corporations also fuel food insecurity by pushing small-scale farmers and local producers out of the system. Smallholder farmers actually feed most of the world, unlike the type of industrial agri-enterprises global agribusiness serves and sometimes owns. Aside from hollowing out or capturing key institutions to forward their agenda, they misleadingly conflate strengthening and expanding their global supply chains, destroying indigenous sources of food production in doing so, with serving the food needs of the world. Again, nothing new here. Now, Russian grain is substantial, so, you know, globally, maybe less than 70%. But not only Russia's government, but the sanctions have ensure that Russia can't be a part of any of this. We're talking about profiteering on a massive scale, which leads to the vulnerability of food supplies. Of course, we're talking about a decentralized system based on short supply chains. The very, very principle of smallholder agriculture and hence agrarianism. The regime has a vision, not just for agriculture, but for the world, as we all know. He coins the military digital financial complex. In other words, the Pentagon, Silicon Valley, and of course the major banks. It's nothing new that they have attempted in many ways succeeded to reshape the world to the point today that they have redefined terms like food and human. Human beings don't have abstract cultures. They have nations within which culture takes root. Of course, they're also redefining terms like nature. This is one of the highest manifestations of Tikkun Olam I've come across, showing how the Kabbalah and Jews are at the center of a lot of this, at least ideologically. This so-called food transition, as they keep talking about, displacing what's left of normal agriculture, replacing it with drones, machines, food becomes synthetic, genetically engineered, sort of edible things. As we all know, ethnic groups, races are to be eradicated. Well, almost all of them. And humanity is to be totally urbanized. These smart cities and completely alienated from the natural world, which will include natural law, a tenet of which is the creation of ethnic communities based around language and religion. What does it mean to be human prior to Darwin and the Industrial Revolution? Well, some of it lay in our connection to nature, not to mention what we did prior to this revolution, cultivating food. More abstractly, Aristotle correctly stated that man is a rational animal, or a reasoning animal, and is hence free. Now, of course, also man is subject to the passions. A man that can control and channel these passions and drives through reason is really what a man is meant to be. Animals are controlled entirely by passions, manifest as instinct. They don't have individual souls. I know Thomas Aquinas said they have a genre-specific soul, or a species-specific soul, one large one. Mankind is a very different story. The regime, through marketing and advertising, wants to reduce reason to mere logic and to be able to control people via passions, which has been the very concept of the sexual revolution. Todd Hunter makes an argument very similar to one that I've made a million times, coming among other people, Johann Herder. The ancient rituals and celebrations, which are now almost entirely forgotten, these rituals humanized the natural order, but it also brought about an understanding of existence and death, rebirth, fertility. Religion is a central part of this, culturally embedded beliefs, sanctifying the practical relationship with nature, which Christ had completed through logos. Plato on the one side, and his and St. Justin Martyr on the other. These customs, philosophical ideas, are connected in one way or another with the planting and harvesting of crops and these seasonal things. Beliefs and rituals spoke of renewal, although a cycle which the wheel of recurrence Christ smashed, or the eternal return wheel. But everything along the lines of sun, seeds, animals, rain, soils, fire, changing seasons, this is the foundation of natural law. This was man's first understanding of the regularity of nature and its specific manifestations in specific places and time, the foundation of the nation, of the ethnic group. And this led to the revelation, both the Old Testament and its completion in Jesus Christ as logos. Now, I mentioned Sylvia Guarini before. She talks about the importance of these deep-rooted relationships and these rituals. She's getting into dangerous territory here. She says that through these, a community recognizes itself and its place in the world, the spirit of a rooted community, by contributing to making a single existence endure over time within a territory, within a community. Now, that's a very good approach to racial and ethnic nationalism. She talks about abstract community like a lot of these weirdo communitarians do, without understanding or not wanting to understand that community doesn't exist without a common language, religion, and tradition, race, and ethnicity. And of course, this is very closely connected with our relationship with farming and food, the family meal, and all this stuff, connections to land, natural law, and the inherently ethnic community that's defined what it means to be a man and a woman. This is classic agrarian nationalism. Agrarianism is based on cooperation, labor, and fellowship. Well, fellowship doesn't work with millions of hostile illegals, migrants being brought to destroy communities and towns. That is the opposite. That's the negation of community. Now, she won't go that far, but she has no other choice. The negation of this, beyond that, is, of course, advanced capitalism, urban life, and the new turn in technology. This is completely opposed to real independence, not to mention human dignity. Agrarianism is not merely material. Many of you are well aware of my writings on this regard. Widespread property ownership, basic decentralization as much as possible relative to the geopolitical landscape at the time, rural society. None of this is a leftist idea. Wendell Berry, who's, you know, all right. I mean, he did a lot to propagate agrarianism. He says, the revolution, which began with machines and chemicals, now continues with automation, computers, and biotechnology. Okay, no kidding. But Berry is good. You know, he knows that agrarianism is not some sentimental longing like the suburbanites want us to believe. And he, myself, and many others have examples of farms that can outperform industrial agriculture with a third, a quarter of the inputs. But this is going to be cast aside for the centralized technocratic dystopia. The problem is that the genius of, let's say, the Russian peasant commune and the traditional farming communities all over Europe and the world, their tremendous knowledge and understanding of the natural order has long since been forgotten. Their understanding of medicine, some of it is being, strangers from the city, seeing the Russian commune talk about it. These people can talk to animals. They can talk to trees. They predict everything that's going to happen with the harvest. Their knowledge is completely intuitive. I've been through this before. I've written on this before. But let me quote Greene again. She claims to be a feminist now. Now listen. The past becomes something to be erased in order to break the thread that binds us to a history, to a tradition, to a belonging. For the transition towards a new uprooted humanity without a past, without memory, a new humanity dehumanized at its essence, totally in the hands of the manipulators of reality and truth. Now, I wasn't expecting this kind of talk from a leftist, or what she calls herself, a radical ecologist. This sort of argument has been anathema to the left since the 18th century. She heads an organization, now get this, it's called the International Feminist Network Against All Artificial Reproduction, Gender Ideology, and Transhumanism. I don't know, maybe she'll fear the irrelevance of women under this agenda. But what she said and what I just quoted, that's not a bad definition of the left in general. Now, this dehumanized monstrosity is part of the wider agenda of transhumanism and one of the final gnosis of what happens when Logos and Plato's forms, which are found in Logos, are denied. Tikkun Olam. Of course, they want a world without farmers and certainly without agrarianism. But Guarini also talks about a world without mothers. I wonder if she supports abortion. I don't know how she could. She says that those behind test tube babies and things like surrogate motherhood are talking about artificial wombs, all kinds of engineering, cutting women out of the reproductive process. And she goes on to talk about artificial wombs. Maybe it'll be marketed, justified by the transgender crazies. In the EU, language around pregnancy doesn't talk about women at all. Persons who can get pregnant. I know that's from the UK and a few other places. I'm hoping that a lot of this will push establishment leftists away from the left. This woman is on the brink of total expulsion from society with this kind of writing. And I hope you also notice that this is yet one of the hundreds of identical ideological components between capitalism and Marxism. Because as I've said about 9,000 times, one of Lenin's dreams was the total mechanization of the countryside. Marxism and capitalism are based on the exact same thing. I think Lenin and Stalin wanted to speed it up, but they didn't have the technology in the 20s to do what's happening now. Gene editing, now a well-funded reality. The point, as Todd Hunter says, is to marry artificial intelligence, bio-nanotechnology, and genetic engineering to produce this one-world transhuman. The sheer amount of money that these big foundations are pouring into this kind of thing, defining what science is, and of course using this, the transgenic leftist and fag organizations, are a central part of this. The freak transgender agenda is based precisely on this, or seeks this to be made popular. It's an attack on life. It's an attack on nature. It's an attack on, as she would say, what is born as opposed to artificial. And that the regime has to sever all ties with the natural world for us common folk. Now, she's a little late to the party. She acts like she's discovered something new. But it's interesting. Can stuff like this push leftists out of that very comfortable world? There is no left-right argument because the left is the regime. It is entirely leftist, differing only in particulars, not on fundamentals. But taking arguments that people like me and many others, got Russell Kirk talk like this. I mean, he didn't understand AI or anything, but basically the same conception. But she can't shoehorn this into a leftist or even a remotely feminist idea. I mentioned that maybe she's scared of the irrelevance of women that may come from artificial wombs. From a feminist point of view, not from a Christian point of view. It's interesting. A report came out called The Future of Food, financed by Sainsbury's, which is a very large UK supermarket chain. I don't know if they're in the US or anywhere else. But they told me they're advocating. They talk about a future where microchipping, tracking, and the neural laces, which was once mentioned in House MD, the TV show, that has the potential to have all of our genetic and situational data recorded, stored, and analyzed via algorithms, dictating what kind of drone food we need to support us. And of course, this is, advertising and journalism promotes this as personal optimization. Much of what the regime says about health and food is nonsense. But this kind of thing that Sainsbury's is talking about, again, this is a huge supermarket chain financing this. This is about getting what the regime considers key nutrients through implants. Now, a neural lace is, I've seen this before, it's a very thin mesh implanted underneath the skull, or on the skull in some cases, with electrodes capable of monitoring brain function. It's used in brain surgery from time to time, creating this communication between the brain and the machine. Now, the soul and the mind are not the brain. The two, the brain is a part of it, but only a part of it. And they're celebrating and advocating this AI warped world of food, and they have to redefine food in the process. He calls this techno-feudalism and transhumanism. Has the regime overplayed their hand? And I wonder, because the financial resources aren't, that they just assume everything's going to be the same for the next 100 years. The level of debt in Western societies is unrepayable. Arrogance and myopia, that turns out to be their true weakness, their Achilles heel. On a more practical level, I want to quote from Todd Hunter again, and this is a very good passage from the same 2022 book. In 2015, the North American Free Trade Agreement led to the direct investment in food processing and a change in Mexico's retail structure, that is, towards supermarkets and convenience stores, as well as the emergence of global agribusiness and transnational food companies in the country. NAFTA and what came after it, eliminated rules preventing foreign investors from owning more than 49% of a company. It also prohibited minimum amounts of domestic content in production and increased rights for foreign investors to retain profits and return from initial investments. By 1999, U.S. companies had invested almost $6 billion in Mexico's food processing industry, 25 times an increase in just over a decade. American food corporations began to colonize the dominant food distribution networks of small-scale vendors, then known as tiendas, or corner shops. This helped spread nutritionally poor food as they allowed these corporations to sell and promote their foods to poor populations in small towns and communities. By 2012, retail chains had displaced tiendas as Mexico's main source of food. In Mexico, the loss of food sovereignty induced catastrophic changes to the nation's diet, and many small-scale farmers lost their livelihoods. which was further accelerated by the dumping of surplus commodities, that is, produced at below the cost of production due to subsidies, from the U.S. NAFTA and what succeeded it rapidly drove millions of Mexican farmers, ranchers, and small business into bankruptcy. It's very important to note that either states or Mexico City could do nothing about it because they signed a treaty, as he says, Mexico used to have a law that, prohibited foreign investors from owning more than 49% of a company. That was eliminated. It rejected all kinds of, NAFTA rejected all kinds of discrimination. You have to treat Mexican firms, American firms, British firms, just like a local firm. Countries like China, they have a minimum domestic content in production. NAFTA eliminated that in Mexico. So as the tiendas were being destroyed, no one could do anything about it. Retail chains displaced those tiendas as the main source of retail, bringing these same food-like products to destroy the health. You know, in Greece in the 19th century, heart attacks were non-existent because of their diet of fish, Orthodox fasting, and all this stuff. 20th century, American food penetrated the country to the point where heart attacks became the norm. Dumping is a particularly nasty thing that normally is prohibited by these kind of treaties. Because if something is subsidized, it's below market price, and you can more quickly put local producers out of business. This is, a key argument for protection. Michael Hudson, who's an economist that I know I've cited before, about 10 years ago, he said this. It's by agriculture and control of the food supply that American diplomacy has been able to control most of the third world. The World Bank's geopolitical lending strategy has been to turn countries into food deficit areas by convincing them to grow cash crops, plantation export crops, not to feed themselves with their own food production. Now, I think debt is more powerful than food supply, but he's telling the truth. Food deficit areas, you could have a country like the U.S. could be totally self-sufficient in everything, including people. But in the third world, Mexico can feed itself. But if you convince the big landowners to grow crops for export, all of a sudden the best land is dedicated to that and not to feeding people. I bought flowers for my wife and I could not believe these were roses grown in Ecuador. As if the U.S. can't grow roses? But this sort of nonsense, this is a key element in the creation of dependency. The control of agriculture by the big American firms. That's been a key element in the geopolitical strategy of the regime. The so-called Green Revolution was also exported, a few decades ago, but it was exported by oil interests. And it forced countries, especially India, to adopt capital's chemical and oil-dependent model of agriculture, which meant that it required loans and dependency on Western sources for technology and everything else and a brand new infrastructure. It trapped countries like India. So this was, the Green Revolution really in the 1970s, but still has impact today. It traps countries into a system of debt bondage. Rigged trade relations, fake elections, and a system that, because it's global, is vulnerable to any shock that may happen around the world. And the result of all of this, income, benefits, compared to what they would be if they kept pace with production, have gone down. Inflation, of course, is much higher than you read. I've been through that before. Outsourcing destroyed the American economy. These Ponzi schemes where finance capital claims that a stock buyback is economic growth. But things were made worse through the bailouts, not just of back in the 70s, Chrysler was infamous, but the banking sector. It began in earnest following the 2008 crash, and it returned with greater force just before COVID. And as you've heard me say before, 48 hours after the lockdown was first announced, there was a $2 trillion bailout for the major Wall Street firms. There's another writer, actually, he's a philosophy professor, sort of, Fabio Vigi. He's at Cardiff University in Wales. And he said this: some may have started wondering why the usually unscrupulous ruling elites decided to freeze the global profit-making machine in the face of a pathogen that targets almost exclusively the unproductive, people over 80, in other words. And he talks about just before COVID, the world economy, as I said before, was on the verge of another massive meltdown. And it was the Swiss Bank of International Settlements, BlackRock, the major G7 central bankers, which are really, you know, they sit on BlackRock's board and vice versa, and many others, needed to avert this impending financial meltdown of utterly mammoth proportions. The lockdown was that global suspension of economic transaction and was meant to permit the Federal Reserve to flood the failing financial markets under the guise of COVID aid with new money while shutting down the real economy. This is the main cause of our present inflation. I said it at the time. Those who have been listening and reading me for a long time, I said you can't have constant printing of money, bailouts, with almost zero production. I mean, the U.S. is a deindustrialized economy. What you're going to have is inflation. Now, prices have been skyrocketing in America for at least the last 15 years. But of course, according to the normies, it only existed a few years ago when the media noticed this and began talking about it. Let me quote Vigi again. And he's summing up what I'm talking about. The stock market didn't collapse in March 2020 because the lockdowns had to be imposed. Rather, lockdowns had to be imposed because financial markets were collapsing. With lockdowns came the suspension of business transactions, which drained the demand for credit and stopped the contagion. In other words, restructuring the financial architecture through extraordinary monetary policy was contingent on the economy's engine being turned off. Now, among many other things, that is almost the very definition of totalitarianism. Now, it's funny, professors, I'm not mentioning any names, were fired for making very similar statements just a few years ago. Of course, the whole thing was a multi-trillion-dollar bailout for Wall Street. But beyond that, we're talking about this capitalist emergency restructuring, the restructuring of capitalism, driving out what's left of small business. Again, this is nothing new. But to these guys, apparently, it's new. I guess they're allowed to say this now, but it has to be within a leftist context, which means they don't understand it. Now, maybe secretly, Vigi is a different story. He just can't say certain things. The left can kind of say things like that. They just kind of have to throw in the occasional feminist line or anti-white comment, and they usually can get away with it. I can't say that, however. But it all means, ultimately, that they completely misunderstand and miss the point of all this stuff. But fundamentally, what he's saying here is correct. The unemployment rate is much higher. I've said this a bunch of times before, than is being reported, because the methods of reporting have changed so radically since 1980. I know the shadow statistics guys say if you use 1979, 1980 methods on 2024 unemployment, it's something like 20 to 25%. Now, the regime is, they act like they're not in a position of strength, but they are very paranoid about dissent and any kind of resistance because their rule is based on the maintenance of public myths that have to be believed. The result of all that is this surveillance state controlling everything from freedom of movement and, of course, as we all know, protest and free speech, unless, of course, it's a race riot against whites. These, however, are only used against right-wing dissidents. You start getting into dangerous territory. This top-down surveillance capitalism, which is not a bad way to describe it, starts talking about the unproductive, useless eaters, and their public ideology and their actual policy become two very different things. Now, I talked about the Black Monk. I've spoken about Tikkun Olam, the notion of fixing the world. This is identical here because the elite, the regime is saying that they can replace nature, changing the very nature of food, genetics, synthetic biology, genetic engineering, whatever. And of course, removing farmers from the land and destroying what's left of the farming world. This AI farming, buying up of land. I talked about it relative to Ukraine, Western and Central Ukraine, as a experimentation ground for GMO, certain GMOs. And since this stuff's going to be made in a lab, the countryside will be filled with wind farms and solar panels. And I'm sure soy will be a big part of it. Of course, you know, who voted for this? They don't even know that it's going on. You have regular farmers' protests from Germany to India. And they're all connected, despite people not understanding this. What's left of your medium-sized farmer, which they do exist in certain places, they can't make a living. I mean, that's old news, but it keeps getting worse and worse. It's the nature of liberal economics. Importing things that undermines domestic production, deliberately undercutting domestic producers. These ridiculous net zero emissions policies. I always said that the mockery of rural whites, you know, white trash and rednecks from, you know, stand-up comedians, this is no, we can't say this really about anyone else but whites. But that's designed to humiliate and hence justify the destruction of rural areas. Farming being made almost impossible. I mean, financially impossible. But this has started since the 1970s. Most of the small farms have long since been destroyed, but what's left are driven off the land that started in early modern Britain with the enclosure movement, ramming through an agenda that seems designed to produce shortages. Now, Todd Hunter is apparently just getting this memo, but what he says is true. Again, he makes reference to a digital corporate financial complex, as I've mentioned before, meant to transform all aspects of life and all the definitions of the major words that we use. I've talked about this for years now. The UN, the World Economic Forum, the WTO, and the World Bank, and all the rest. Gates, Rockefeller Foundations, Carnegie, and all the rest of it. I was very disappointed in the latest BRICS document, the final document. Many of you have probably read it. It gives credence to global warming, which is a very stupid myth. I know I've said this before, but my freshman year in college, it had just become trendy. And all the pseudo-intellectual students were out there protesting, and I don't know who they were protesting to on campus, but it became a big deal. If you remember at the time, Rush Limbaugh going on and on about it, but every single one of their predictions didn't come true. Every single one. Food transition. This is a new slogan, which again locks farmers into this dependency on corporate controlled seeds and GMO. Farmers themselves will be bearing all of the risk. This is a predatory commercialization of the countryside that began with the monetization of the countryside. And today, one of the, if not the main, argument is that we have to save humanity from global warming. The same was with the pseudoscience of COVID, which was designed to shut down dissent. And if that didn't work, the riots for the make-believe George Floyd murder, utter nonsense, were to keep specifically white people at home. And that was culminating in the January 6th persecution. But the regime is the one who funds science, determines what should be studied, how it should be studied, and what to do with the information. Yes, they smear and destroy those who dissent, but it only happens when a writer will veer into rightist, nationalist, or Christian directions. Apparently, the prevailing theory is that the problems humanity has had forced on it are to be solved by the same people who created it. This is the very definition of the regime. Financial oligarchy, media, centralized states, liberal ideology, the military, and all this as a single functioning unit. And it's extremely disconcerting to see this manifest in food production. No one wants this. Everything from self-transmitting vaccines, genetic engineering of plants, of human beings, synthetic food, transhumanism, attacks on gender. This is the postmodern paradigm that concentrates power and co-opts technical and scientific expertise. The American diet leads to ill health. It is sugar-based, it's starch-based. It is made worse in this food transition by the use of chemicals, even beyond GMOs. BlackRock has heavily invested in this, not to mention pharmaceuticals. And the state has been entirely privatized. There are life forms who have been patented, trading in carbon, corporate dependency, land investments. Of course, all of these using global warming or COVID as a cover for amassing and protecting great wealth. Shutting down debate is extremely important to them. Governments, especially in Europe, of course the US, are massively in debt to the major banks. And that could only mean massive austerity measures. I think we live really in a de facto austerity system. But of course, you have massive increases in military spending to challenge the one place that can put an end to this, and that's Russia. Russia, Belarus, parts of Central Asia, the Russo-Chinese alliance. Just in 2020, I think I've mentioned this before, but late March to July of that year, the total wealth held by the world's billionaires grew from $8 trillion to $10 trillion. And you have this younger group of often Jewish billionaires wanting to, again, fix the world using these emerging technologies, continuing to act as revolutionaries that they are. And then you have, you know, Republican candidates for office talking about how great all of this is. This doesn't come up anywhere. And all of these new products have been patented by Gates and others. One example, which he brings up, I'm happy he did it, Ginkgo Bioworks. This is a Gates-financed company, new company, that makes, quote, custom organisms. It's now public, $17.5 billion deal. It's patented something called cell programming technology. And what they're trying to do, and what they have done, is engineer flavors and scents and textures into, in this case, commercial strains of engineered yeast and bacteria. And they actually call these natural ingredients. So the plan is to create up to 20,000 engineered cell programs, according to ToddHunter. It only has 5 as of right now, for food products and a million other things. Charges customers to use this, quote, biological platform. But when I say customers, we're not talking about me and you. We're talking about the regime. We're talking about the major corporations in this field. As always, Marxism and advanced capitalism have the same goals, the same means, the same purposes, and the same ideological and ontological foundations. Marxism really is the Jewish attempt to speed up the process, though it was done in the early 20th century, where this kind of technology simply didn't exist. There was even a government office in the USSR under Stalin called the office or the Bureau for Man's Control Over Nature. And that was the actual name of it. I don't know if I've dealt with that before. I may have. Another author who I've cited many times is F. William Engdahl. And he says, and this should, again, this is something I've said before, but I want to quote him anyway. No one group has done more to damage our global agriculture and food quality than the Rockefeller Foundation. They began in the early 1950s, after the war, to fund 2 Harvard Business School professors to develop vertical integration, which they named agribusiness. The farmer became the least important. They then created the fraudulent Green Revolution in Mexico and India in the 1960s and 70s, and later the pro-GMO Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa since 2006. Now, of course, we know that there's one country in the world, I doubt it's the only one, where GMOs are illegal, and that's in in Russia. Rockefellers, all the other huge foundations, which, by the way, are called charities in the major media. You remember about 15 years ago when Bill Gates and Berkshire Hathaway, or Warren Buffett, quote-unquote, gave all their money to charity, or like 90% of it? Well, it's all in how you define charity. Charity is the foundations that they control. Since they're tax-exempt, they get to be called charities. The Rockefeller Foundation, I don't know if it was over the summer, came out with The True Cost of Food, Measuring What Matters to Transform the U.S. Food System. Now, this allegedly is now the global consensus. The ridiculous concept of sustainable agriculture in the post-COVID breakdown. There's nothing positive about this. It's to alter our access to healthy food or real food. Rockefeller's just released this is a second food report in 2 or 3 years, and is now connected with the Davos World Economic Forum and people like Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland to lead the drive. The president of the foundation, Rajiv Shah, says this: "We spent the past year working with experts and advocates across the field to measure the impact of the American food system. The result is the first U.S.-wide set of metrics that can help us measure the cost of our food more accurately. With this new analysis, governments, advocates, food producers, and individuals are better equipped to transform our food system to be more nourishing, regenerative, and equitable." Now, the Rockefeller Foundation created this problem in the first place, or financed the creation of this problem in the first place. They're blaming their own creation for the huge external costs of food. Now, I've defined oligarchy as different from capitalism in that what it rewards is, of course, privatizing profits or income and externalizing costs. Well, the true costs of food are these externals that are borne by others. Something called the True Price Foundation, which is part of this report. Normally, the cost of the U.S. food system is about $1 trillion. That's how much Americans spend yearly on food. But they claim it's more like $3.5 trillion, talking about the impact on the health of people, livelihoods, etc. Well, this is their own creation. They're talking about cancer and diabetes. Well, who's the one who financed all this stuff in the first place? Then they start talking about carbon dioxide, CO2 emissions. The True Cost Foundation has just three people. Herman Mulder, former banker with ABN AMRO, which is actually connected to agribusiness. Charles Evers, the former corporate controller and CFO of Unilever, itself a huge agribusiness. And Jasper DeJong, a partner at Allen and Overy, largest law firms connected to this stuff. These are the people who are behind this agenda. The true cost of food is pretty much a who's who of the elite in this area. Of course, not a single farmer was included in this or any agricultural organization. They created this problem, and now they're using the problem that they created to amass even more power. They're talking about the cost of food concerning the cost of obesity, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, all of these non-communicable things, claiming that, it adds another $1 trillion to food costs. But since the 1950s, this has been the norm. Agrochemicals, the monopolies, Monsanto, Bayer, and DuPont, Dow, or Corteva. But they will blame not these groups, but medium-sized and small farms. They're the ones to blame, and of course, they're the ones who are going to pay. The message, of course, is that the normal farmer is to blame. And to save the planet, they need to be completely removed. The report, as Engdahl says, is very vague and very deceptive. They don't talk about the nature of GMO crops, the Monsanto Bayer Roundup, and all the rest. They omit all of this. They have promoted and initially financed Monsanto and the GMO movement for decades, well aware of its danger. But that isn't the point. I mentioned Rajiv Shah. He used to work for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He was the director of agricultural development. He, of course, has no connection to farming, just like the commissars that controlled peasant agriculture in the USSR had no connection to farming. They were urban Jews who've never seen a farm before. And all of this is tied to the Davos World Economic Forum, where Shah actually chaired the Global Future Council on the new agenda for economic growth and recovery. This is utter nonsense. The few people who actually will bother to read it. Sustainable agriculture is the new slogan. But there's something else. In 2024, there was an article by a guy named Hunter Fielding, and he said this. The United States has joined 12 other nations in signing a World Economic Forum agreement that seeks to engineer global famine by destroying the agriculture industry. According to the agreement, which was drawn up by the WEF and the UN, food production is causing global warming and must be eliminated. You did hear that right. Food is causing the problem. They're saving the planet from climate change, so farms must be shut down across the world. This agreement sets targets for how much farmland each government has to eliminate in order to comply. They're pretending this has something to do with methane emissions. 13 governments signed this pledge to engineer this famine. There's something called the WEF Global Methane Hub. This crisis engineers. And by the way, these 13 states are Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Burkina Faso, Chile, the Czech Republic, Ecuador, Germany, Panama, Peru, Spain, the U.S., and Uruguay. And of course, here meat is to be completely eliminated. Marcelo Mina, who is the CEO of the Global Methane Hub, says food systems are responsible for 60% of methane emissions, that farming and food are destroying the planet. Only the postmodern age could create crap like this. The solution, of course, is to shut down farms that they don't control. It's a blatant call, as Kamala Harris recently called for, a reduced white population, since whites can be destroyed with impunity. But that the population agenda isn't a secret anymore. So in order to be considered a establishment intellectual of good standing, you actually have to believe that food and the production of food and farming is causing global warming. One of the guys promoting this is someone I met a long time ago in New Hampshire in the 92 campaign, former senator and former secretary of state John Kerry. Now he's a special presidential envoy for the climate. And he said, mitigating methane is the fastest way to reduce warming in the short term. Food and agriculture can contribute to a low methane future by improving farmer productivity and resilience. We welcome agriculture ministers participating in implementation of this global methane pledge. The point, of course, is to drive meat prices through the roof so the regime will force the eating of insects. Meat will be available only to the wealthy. There was a critic here named Leo Homan. I'm going to quote him here too, and he's talking about the same thing. We can presume from this language that among the practices being considered are replacing a major portion of the beef and dairy cattle, pork and chicken stocks that populations rely on for protein, with insect larvae, mealworms, crickets, and the rest. The UN, World Economic Forum, and other NGOs have been promoting meatless diets and the consumption of insect protein for years, and billionaires have invested in massive insect factories being built in Illinois and parts of Canada, the Netherlands, where mealworms, crickets, and other bugs will be processed as additives to be inserted into the food supply, often without clear labels that will inform people of exactly what they are eating. The Deagle forecast, he cites, projecting a 70% reduction in the American, that is, white population by in just a few years. Now, initially, it was for 2025, but he says, there is no more efficient way to depopulate than through war, famine, and plague. Isn't it interesting that all three of these time-tested methods of murder are in play right now? Now, I don't know if you noticed this, but it's only white women who are refusing to have children. I've come across so many of these. This agenda is race-specific, at least for now. Michael Snyder wrote in the Economic Collapse blog, which I recommend for the most part. He says this, global food supplies just keep getting tighter, and global hunger has risen to extremely alarming levels. According to the UN, nearly 30% of the global population does not have constant access to food right now, and there are approximately 900 million people that are facing severe food insecurity. Now look, if you're eating processed food, you've got to be one of these people. If you're a vegetarian or a vegan, and not a monk, of course, you're one of these people. You're one of these hungry people. Meat, for the most part, is essential. At least part of the year. And the only way to get away with talking like this is if you put it in a leftist and globalist context. However, I'm thinking that the left moving to agrarianism and talking about the methods of regime control, mimicking arguments that I've made 20 years ago, I don't know. Can people like this can see the light of social identity, ethnicity, and the groups who are truly and really in control? But I mentioned a phrase, a neologism, called net zero. This is a regime-created word, and it was coined to mean that nothing will be left once reaching a zero carbon economy. And of course, reducing carbon dioxide to zero, everything dies. The objective, or so it seems, I mean, if food is the problem, and carbon dioxide is a problem, then plant, animal, and human life is going to be eliminated, at least in most of the world. Now, the regime has dropped CO2, really, but has shifted to carbon more generally. The very foundation of all organic life. Julian Rose, who was the first person to bring this issue to my attention, said, "The World Economic Foundation is acting as lead player of the project known as Stop Global Warming, a project which states that a deadly form of anthropogenic warming is being caused by the burning of fossil fuels and that the stated need is therefore to completely dispense with all fossil fuels by 2050. But doing a little elementary research reveals that what one sees coming out of a factory chimney and all these media photographs is not CO2. It's mostly water vapor, carbon monoxide, methane, with this noxious CO2 forming less than 5% of these emissions. In other words, it all comes down to that an essential component of nature, without which life could not exist, has been turned into a poison causing catastrophic changes to the world's climate. It is an absurd idea. This is what net zero means. How do you avoid wiping out huge parts of the planet? Now, does a regime have their own subterranean storage ecosphere? I don't know. But this is pure sociopathy. This is the Great Reset, the Green New Deal, who explicitly have adopted this net zero by 2050. This is the first thing that has to be done to save the planet in the regime's mind, to get rid of the cause behind this alleged destruction of the planet. And as a result, to have the oligarchy take all capital in the process of making us all happy. In the USSR, that just means that they took control of everything. But achieving net zero has to be made palatable to the population, and that is to save the planet. Promoting vegetarianism, veganism are a part of this. And cows, if they will remain at all, have to wear these methane-blocking masks. These masks were just awarded an environmental prize by King Charles for their contribution to slowing global warming. There are demons on the loose. They thrive on two things. They thrive on chaos and fear. They deliberately use manipulative languages, greenhouse gases, methane, carbon, and whatever else they could sell as speeding up this secularized version of Armageddon. They change their arguments all the time. It doesn't really make any difference. And again, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation began funding research on this new phenomenon in 1990. Global warming. By the early 90s, it became a fashionable idea, and you better accept it. By the middle of the 1990s, it was stated with authority to be settled science and irrefutable. Now, much of this has unraveled. They switched from global warming to climate change, I don't know, around 2000. So they're right either way, but warming is still implied. Yeah, there was a brief rise in temperatures between 1895 and 1940. The most extreme warming period being the 25 years from 1910 to 1935, and then a rapid cooling trend afterwards. This is where the American press got its new ice age nonsense from. And it promoted that with the same vehemence as it promoted global warming, both in the 90s and now. But in the mid-70s, fossil fuels had hit their peak consumption. It's very depressing to see that BRICS has accepted this. But the truth of the matter is that predictions of this catastrophic global warming are based on computer models, which is still an infant science. The empirical evidence, to the extent that it really can be gathered in a non-controversial way, shows no man-made warming whatsoever. That for the seven decades since 1940, when the average CO2 levels massively increased, the average temperatures, at least in the U.S., were decreasing. Data doesn't justify the trillions that have already been spent on this nonsense. And no science could ever be settled. But governments, including, unfortunately, BRICS. Now, this is a BRICS document. I don't know if Russia is necessarily 100% on board, but they tend to be, unfortunately. Maybe it's a way to beat up the U.S. But we all know that scientific establishment, not science, these establishments are highly politicized and dependent on grant money. All of their claims, when I was in college, should have happened by now and really by 2000. The myth continues to exist. The reality of the system is due to this climate variability, you can have a decade or two of cooling and then a warming trend. They don't focus on any kind of short-term fluctuation, assuming that they could demonstrate this at all. These fluctuations were well known long before industrialization. Writers like Robinson back in 2007 said the experimental record is consistent. The Earth has been warming as it recovers from the Little Ice Age, maybe 0.5 degrees Celsius per century. But these fluctuations correlate with the activity of the sun. Sea level and glacier length reveal three intermediate uptrends and two downtrends since 1800, to the extent that we can be certain of what the average temperature was in 1800. But we may be more able to pinpoint sea level in glaciers, but I don't know to what extent. You see, the book Tammy Boyce's Climate Change in the Media in 2009 is definitely worth your time. But all of this is very tightly connected to the nature of food production and agrarianism. We all know what a smart city is. This is 1984. In the UK, elites have made the demand that all airports be closed by 2050. Demonizing carbon dioxide, which is the life-giving gas on which all life depends. Lowering these levels can never be good for carbon-based life, and yet this is the obsession. The regime is aiming for lowering global temperatures when the next few decades, I don't know exactly what they change and what their target is, but 10 degrees Celsius at a minimum. We know what the facts are. Solar activity is the foundation of any kind of climate alteration. Another point of view says that this occurs in waves of 11,000 to 20,000 years, smaller cycles in between. Climate changes are very slow and normal. It goes back to 1972, though, the Club of Rome Limits to Growth paper. And the first thing that they said in that, before they started talking about climate change there, is to reduce the population of the world by more than 90%, ultimately because non-renewable resources would then last much longer for the elite. And it's still, that paper is still the blueprint for the Great Reset and the UN Agenda 2030. It's also a very convenient way to decimate populations through droughts, floods, famine, whatever. To what extent geoengineering is a part of this? I talked about it at some length with the Turkish-Syrian earthquake a few years ago. But these demons are certainly on the loose. This fake sustainability, this pseudoscience, which can never be settled. Renewable energy, well, it sounds nice. But to provide maybe 25%, let's say, of the energy requirements of Great Britain, one quarter would require 75% of Britain to be covered with biomass plantation. Now, at the local level, it's a very different story. We're not talking about massive institutions. the windmills required to provide the UK with its 20 watt hours amount to 50 times the entire wind hardware of Denmark, 7 times the wind farms in Germany, and double the entire fleet of all wind turbines in the world. It simply can't be done. And the assumptions that are built into this, the nonsense, and of course shutting down all, whenever they have to shut down debate, it needs to be met with great suspicion. Because that doesn't come from a position of strength. If there is a solution at all, an industrialization, of course, you know, promised the universe to us. And just like the Rockefeller Foundation, they blame their own policies for the disasters. Or the, they don't blame their own policies, but they blame for policies that they've created. They're talking about it as if they had nothing to do with it, and we need more power in order to fix it. And they're just starting. Economic collapse may be the only thing that can save us for now. And it doesn't matter who gets elected. This is where we live. It sounds extreme, the cyborgs and transhumans and all of that. But you already have patents for some of this stuff. The pseudo-intellectualism has to stop. I know I've gone on for too long. I couldn't spend much time in any one thing, but this is all connected in one ideological mesh that threatens to destroy us all. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk, as always. I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.